Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Hey, good evening, everyone. Welcome to another Wednesday night installment here at Your Remedy is in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're discussing various IRS administrative remedies and promoting our speaker's book, I Object. My name is Martin Michaels. I'll be your host for this evening's conference, brought to you by Your Remedy is in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer. Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedy is in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. Should you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do where they similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless. And it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedies in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com, if we look in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are of much importance, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure. Better known to some as American jurisprudence or AMJUR, the rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes a lot of the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course, so it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known majorly for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Both of these items are very affordably priced, the jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of Your Remedy is in the Law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of YourRemedyIsInTheLaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups at Your Remedy is in the Law. And Your Remedy is in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that altogether make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at YourRemediesInTheLaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on very strict pre-decided topics of discussion. Essentially how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you get to a point where it will ask you, what are your hot points? What are you interested in? This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights, anything that you can think of. If it affects your personal rights in one way or another, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together, much of how you think of a social a network, though nothing like a social network. It's very custom. It's very private. But then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be of a tremendous amount of help to you. Maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do where I similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look up these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. And then for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions and all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the farther you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to the point where you've educated yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedoms Radio. If you're over the road, you don't want to deal with the call process, maybe you're just new to your remedies in the law and you don't yet have your username and password, therefore you can't see the phone number and the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button. Fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. But every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night, the calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that'll pop up on the moderator screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air as long as they are appropriate. So you don't get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. There's no cost to utilize Freedoms Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make at your remedies in the law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information providers pay Mr. Everett for advertising at your remedies in the law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that honestly most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. And we make those introductions. Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. Everybody always hopes for the best. We plan for the best, and believe you me, we aim for the best. But unavoidable things do sometimes happen, and when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. Again, we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have had to say about these products and services. Now, let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not that Your Remedy is in the law anyway. Of course, when you come aboard and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right, lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at Your Remedy is in the Law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if a question is posed properly and then answered properly, then we can all learn something from it.
Well, Martin, thank you so very much for that 12-minute disclaimer. We appreciate it. Ladies and gentlemen, we have a first-time caller here tonight. Want to welcome from Stamford, Connecticut. Phone number is ending in 9212. If you'd be so kind to say hello and share with us how you heard about us.
Yeah, hi. My name is Jay. Mr. Slevin is a buddy, so he let me know this was happening, and I'm very excited to listen in.
Oh, wonderful. That's great. Welcome to the call, sir.
Thank you.
All right. Well, this having been said, let's cover a 30,000-foot view of what's going on. I had a phone call earlier this week where someone asked me if Mr. Slevin's LLC replaced the Golden Horseshoe. You know, we've been talking about the Golden Horseshoe for a number of years. Well, decade anyways, if not more. The Golden Horseshoe being the ideal way to operate lawfully / legally, informing the Internal Revenue Service of every step of the way that we're doing. Nothing hidden, no wink, wink, nod, nod, no elbow in the ribs. No secrets, just privacy. And within the Golden Horseshoe, there is a need to acquire an LLC. The LLC that Judge Beshear wrote, authored, is very, very unique and is designed to fit hand in glove with all of the other parts of this Golden Horseshoe. Not long ago, I was introduced to Mr. Slevin, and Mr. Slevin shared with us what his LLC is, how it operates, and I shared this with Justice Beshear, and we determined that Mr. Slevin's LLC is actually superior in its form and function to what is want to be accomplished, and no, it doesn't replace the Golden Horseshoe. It interfaces perfectly with the Golden Horseshoe, plus has the added benefit of allowing you to initiate the process by starting with the LLC and preferably two charitable religious trusts that you would be the trustee to at this time. By doing and arranging your commercial affairs in such a way, you've accomplished many things. One, you're spending $7,500 for Mr. Slevin's LLC. You're spending $1,000 for each of the two charitable religious trusts, which are deemed non-taxpayers by the IRS, to which you control as the trustee. And then at a later time in the future, you can then interface that, plug it in to the Golden Horseshoe, Now, when you just approach us for the Golden Horseshoe to begin with, from scratch, you're looking at $35,000. So now you're able to do what you need to do for your commercial application, or if you're an employee, to reposition yourself from an employee to a worker for this LLC. And you will strip the exposure to being liable for the taxes that you would normally be paying as an employee and other things as well, enabling you to just do a tremendous amount of things, which Mr. Slevin will be getting into in a moment. So I just want to share with you that this is the most awesome tool to utilize, to initiate with, or for other people who are wealthy and just want to come in and do it right. We've supplanted the LLC within the Golden Horseshoe, which would independently cost you $5,000, with the LLC that Mr. Slevin offers at $7,500. So it's a win-win all the way down the line for you, regardless of where you jump in and get started. So with that having been said, we got another first-time caller here. Doesn't have a city-state associated with it. This is someone ending in with a phone number ending in 9934. May I have your first name only, please? Tell us where you how you heard about us.
Sam, I heard about you from an iron worker friend of mine at a refinery job.
Ah, super. Welcome to the call, Sam.
Thank you.
Without further ado, it's my pleasure to turn the call over to Mr. Slevin. Go ahead, buddy.
Good morning, Vietnam. Oh, wait. Long split. Never mind. Hi, guys. How are you doing this weekend? So we hey, Michael, I've got to keep you off your, you know, on your toes. Whatever. All right. So the two things that you want to protect in this world are yourself and your stuff. And when you protect yourself, you're talking about your personal body and your family and that sort of thing. And of course, your stuff is everything you can own, whether that be tangible or intangible. So that's what we're going to two-prong this little message here tonight. So the organic document of this country, of the United States of America, is the Declaration of Independence, which, of course, was published July 4, 1776. Now, this is probably the most quoted and probably the most important piece of that document. Quote, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creators with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." Pause there. When this was written, and I've read how Jefferson and Franklin and the others that worked on this declaration talked about it, they started out saying life, liberty, and property. And they felt it was too limiting, and so that's why they threw in the pursuit of happiness. Of course, in order to pursue happiness and have life, property must be involved, because you don't live without being able to eat, right? If you don't have food, you die. If you don't have water, you die. If you don't have oxygen. So these are property. And so they came out of that. So back to the quote. "Among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. That whenever any form of government becomes destructive to these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new governments, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness," end quote. So, powerful words, but it really lays a nice foundation for the country and for the republic of which it was created. So, and I would suggest everybody go ahead and read that every so often, particularly all of the injustices which the crown had placed upon the colonies at that point, to use broad brushes. They, you know, it's horrific. And they did everything they could, everything that was humanly possible to correct those. But of course, King George being the potentate, believing he had divine right to rule we the people, just wouldn't listen. So much the worse for him. The Declaration of Independence is a masterful work of reason, where reason, with a capital R, is a logical process to move through an obstacle and overcome that obstacle and fix it or make it right. Now, this thing called reason is actually ordained by God. In Isaiah 1:18, quote, "Come now, let us reason together, says the Lord. Though your sins are like scarlet, they shall be as white as snow. Though they are red like crimson, they shall be like wool." End quote. Isn't that a fantastic visual of setting what is perceived to be a wrong to right? It's mind-boggling. And we'll get into some reason at a later date. So after we the people declared our independence from England and the monarchy thereof, the sovereignty of that construct devolved upon each of us, we, capital W-E, the people with a capital P. And this was probably best said by the Supreme Court in a case called Chisholm v. Georgia of 1793. Just a few years after this great country enjoyed its independence. Quote, "The same feudal ideas run through all their jurisprudence." Let me pause there. The feudal system is what was all over Europe and other parts of the world is too, but that was the main thing that they looked at. And when it says all of their jurisprudence, it talks about the European countries. "The same feudal ideas run through all their jurisprudence and consistently remind us of the distinction between the prince and the subject. No such idea obtains here. At the revolution, the sovereignty devolved on the people, and they are truly the sovereigns of the country. But they are sovereigns without subject. Unless the African slaves among us may be called so. Close print. And have none to govern but themselves. The citizens of America are equal as fellow citizens and as joint tenants in the sovereignty." So we're all kings and queens. We are all rulers of ourselves. We have, we are truly free men. And we use that in the capital, as men is the plural of an individual one of mankind. So, in other words, we really own ourselves and our bodies and the production thereof. All of this, each individual owns. And we are entitled to that, or endowed, as the Declaration of Independence says. So, we've got this truly magnificent thing. This human body and all its complexities and all of its incredible possibilities and opportunities. So with that comes great responsibility, because being that we relate to other men, we relate via this thing called a contract. And you have the full power and the range of the contract. You have full authority to do these contracts, but you must be very careful, because you can easily trade away this endowment for nothing. The authority of this entitlement empowers us to make these contracts. And we must strictly consider that by making those agreements, one can not be taken advantage of, or not trade away the production or the body for mere promises. Now, one of these was done by Benjamin Franklin, and he wrote, "Those who would give up essential liberty to purchase a little temporary safety deserve neither liberty nor safety." In other words, if you do not consider and strictly consider the contract, then you are being foolish. And this was probably best shown in the Bible in Genesis 25:29-34, where Esau, who was the hunter, had went out and he was he comes in and he's famished, and his brother Jacob was cooking porridge, and Esau says, "You got to give me some of that because I'm going to starve to death. I'm going to die right here." He was probably a little overdramatic as well. So Jacob says, "Sure, sell me your birthright." And Esau made this crazy comment about, "Well, what good is it if I'm dead? So yes, I trade you my birthright." He did not consider, and this was the birthright of the father Abraham. This was a kingdom for all intents and purposes. So Esau traded away his birthright for a bowl of porridge. Ladies and gentlemen, I would suggest do not do this, and do not be fooled into doing this. So before we move on, let's take a little time to address that parenthetical comment in Chisholm about the African slaves. Now, as I said, Chisholm was in 1793, just a few years after the Revolution and the Constitution were brought into being. So, you know, the Chisholm thing seems to leave the Negro out in the cold. So the Constitution addressed slavery, and it was in Article 1, Section 9, Clause 1. "The migration or importation of such persons as any of the states now existing shall think proper to admit shall not be prohibited by the Congress prior to the year 1808. But a tax or duty may be imposed on such importations," being slaves, "not exceeding $10 for each person." So here they addressed the slaves as a person. So that particular section of the Constitution was codified by the Act Prohibiting Importation of Slaves, which was 1807, and it became law on January 1st of 1808, which was the date stated in the Constitution. That didn't change the climate internally. You still had slave states and free states and territories of that thing. So the expansion of the early 1800s, the Louisiana Purchase and so forth, and the discovery of the by Lewis and Clark and that sort of thing, caused a great division in the states. We have free states, slave states, free territories, slave territories, and so on. So there was a big mess on that, and lots of fighting going on in there, and this conflict engendered something called the Dred Scott v. Stanford decision of 1856. Now, this is as far as I know right now, this is the longest SCOTUS decision ever written. It's like some 250 pages. So, if you ever have insomnia, just try reading the Dred Scott decision and you will go fast asleep, guaranteed. Anyway, so, Dred Scott was a slave of Dr. Sanford, and he had been given a wife, and daughters came from that marriage, and they had been moving around through the different slave and free territories. And so Dred considered himself free, and then Dr. Sanford sold his wife and children, and he sued, trying to use the district courts of the United States to rectify or remedy this injury he felt. So the court ruled against Dred, and all the justices weighed in, but Justice Daniel stated this, quote, "This was an action of trespass vi et armis instituted in a circuit court," that's what district courts used to be called, circuit courts, "of the United States for the District of Missouri. In the name of the plaintiff in error, a Negro held as a slave for the recovery of freedom for himself, his wife, and two children, also Negroes," end quote. So he makes the statement. This is what he was trying to do: use the courts. So the but then Daniel's brought forth a really interesting thing. It's from writings from the Emperor Justinian in the 6th century of Roman Empire. This is at page 479, a part of the Supreme Court decision. It says, quote, "The above account of slavery and its modifications will be found in strictest conformity with the Institutes of Justinian. Thus, in Book 1, Title 3, it is said, quote, the first general division of people in respect to their rights is into free men and slaves." Only two divisions there. The same title, section 4, says, "Slaves are born such or become so. They are born such of bond women." Remember that title. Remember that name. Word. "They become so either by the law of nations, as by capture, or by civil law. You could at one time be condemned to be a slave." Section 5. "In the condition of slaves there is no diversity, but among free persons there are many. Thus some are ingenii, or free men, or libertini, or freed men." In Title 4, quote, "A free man is one who is born free of being born in matrimony, of parents who both are free and both freed, or of parents, one free and the other freed. But one born of a free mother, although the father be slave or unknown, is free." Let me repeat that. "One born of a free mother, although the father be a slave or unknown, is free." So when the 13th Amendment was ratified December 6, 1865, it says, "Neither, quote, neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as punishment for a crime whereas the party shall have been duly convicted, shall exist within the United States or in any place subject to their jurisdiction," end quote. You notice it says involuntary servitude, but as we talked about earlier, you can contract to be a servant, a slave, or indentured, if you will. So because of the 13th Amendment, the bond on all women in America and its territories was extinguished. Therefore, after the 1865 ratification, any human born in America or its areas was free man. They occupied the same status as the We the People sovereignty spoken about in Chisholm v. Georgia. Just a note, just a little bit about how much you've probably been lied to over the world. This was actually, the 1865 was actually the second 13th Amendment. Now, the following comes from New Hampshire House Bill 638 in the 2013 session. Quote, "In 1810, a proposed amendment to the United States Constitution, which prohibited titles of nobility and which later became known as the original 13th Amendment, was introduced, passed by both houses of Congress, and sent to the states for ratification. On December 9, 1812, shortly after ratification by Virginia, New Hampshire became the 13th state to ratify the amendment. The amendment was therefore ratified by the requisite number of states and became Article 13 of the United States Constitution. The original Article 13 reads, if any citizen of the United States shall accept, claim, receive, or retain any title of nobility, such as Esquire, or honor, or shall, without consent of Congress, accept and retain any present pension, office, or emolument of any kind whatever, from any emperor, king, prince, or foreign power, such person shall cease to be a citizen of the United States and shall be incapable of holding any office of trust or profit under them or either of them," being the states, the several states of the Union. So that was done, and that comes from the New Hampshire, and the young fellers that tried to get that run out it was tabled by the leadership of that legislative body, more to our pity, because they just wanted to have it read into and changed the New Hampshire Constitution to fit that original 13th Amendment. So, this original 13th Amendment was one of the reasons that it is said that the British came in and burned Washington City in about 1814. And there were some other financials, and that's another long story. We can get into it some other time. Anyway, a little bit about how you've been lied to. So let's move back to the 1865 version of the 13th Amendment. It is an outlawing of slavery. Okay? So therefore, again, according to Justinian and the law of nations and civil law, there is no bond upon any woman, and therefore there is no slave born. They are all born free people. So the 14th Amendment then was brought into because the recently freed Negroes were not being treated well in the Confederacy. So they brought this together, and they also engineered several things within it to make it rough on anybody who, quote unquote, was insurrectionist. And I believe it was the Georgia. Some people in the Georgia government tried to keep Marjorie Taylor Greene from running again to the House of Representatives because she was supposedly part of the insurrection of January 6th. These people will go to any lengths to retain power. Anyway, so the 14th Amendment came along, and it talked about a lowercase c, citizen of the United States, and that is a separate, distinct citizenship from the original citizens who became sovereigns, we the people sovereigns. The originals are now known as American nationals. The two main things that allow that to take place are the certification of the birth record, or what we now hear as a birth certificate, and the application for Social Security account, which is, I believe, SS5. So, because of those two documents and other machinations, most Americans are, in fact, slaves of the District of Columbia. So in order to remedy that, I highly suggest that everybody get with GW and get that process done to switch that status back to the original We the People sovereignty, a.k.a. American National. And what that does is an effect, because you are now moving from slave to sovereign. You now the boss. So all of these things like traffic tickets, the income tax, and several other things you're no longer under that jurisdiction. You're above that jurisdiction. So not only can you not take that or not be taken to court for any of those infractions, the court just can't see you because there's no jurisdiction there. So this is the most efficient way to protect yourself. So now, why would you want to protect your stuff? Because even though you get that back to the We the People sovereignty, or American National as it's known today, you can still be sued. There's some other people out there, be they slave or free, according to the 14th Amendment, they can come in and sue and be sued. So we want to protect our stuff. Now, how do we do that? Okay, so let's go back to the Constitution for a second. Constitution of the United States The Constitution for the United States was officially ratified and therefore approved on June 21st of 1788, okay? Now, the Bill of Rights came in and was ratified on 1791, just before Chisholm, okay? So that is the protection. The Bill of Rights is known as the protection of the We the People sovereigns. And in a case called The slaughterhouse cases, the court, and this is one among many in which GW brings forward in his presentation, that it specifically says that because this case was brought by a group of people, some being freed men and some being free men, then it was brought under the 14th Amendment. And the court says, well, no, because that's not the way to do it, because you have both free men and freedmen within this class suing the government of Louisiana for giving a private corporation carte blanche over the slaughterhouse industry in the three or four it's not counties because they don't call them counties in Louisiana, but anyway, it's the same thing as counties in and around New Orleans. And the court said, so you have the distinction, you have the lowercase c citizens of the United States, and then you have citizens of the several Union states, which is what we now know as America. So the court has multiple times talked about these two statuses. So anyway, back on track. So in 1871, like 100 years later, there was this thing called the District of Columbia Organic Act, all right? And this is an act of Congress that repealed the individual charters of the cities of Washington and Georgetown and established the whole District of Columbia in one territorial government. Some people say also that this is when the District of Columbia became a corporation as well, and there's evidence for that. And some supporting documentation would be 28 United States Code 3002 definitions. As used in this chapter, 15 United States means a federal corporation. Okay? So we can go on into that at some other time. Now, what it truly did was it made D.C. a city-state. It made it absolutely independent of anything in or around it. Right? Now, the other city-states that we find in the world are the City of London, which is a one-square-mile enclave within the greater London United Kingdom, and Vatican City, which is a 110-acre parcel near the center of Rome, Italy. These three city-states comprise the military, financial, and ecumenical power centers of this earth. And folks, these guys that inhabit these cities and are part of the in-the-know crowd, if you will, they truly believe that they own everybody and everything. No matter how the Supreme Court so eloquently said that we are sovereign by our virtue of ridding ourselves of King George, nope, they believe that they own us, and they enforce this this belief with merciless efficiency. Here's a little evidence that D.C. became a city-state, because shortly thereafter they started acquiring foreign property and more slaves, a.k.a. federal citizens. So in 1898, the Spanish-American War broke out, and the use of Pearl Harbor grew to great importance. Now, D.C. acquired the Hawaiian Islands as a territory from Stanford B. Doyle, a Doyle pineapple, who had stolen it from Queen Liliuokalani in 1893 with the assistance of about 300 Marines. So the 1898 Spanish-American War cemented that theft, and the Hawaiian Islands became a territory of D.C. Also, as a result of that war, D.C. acquired the properties of Cuba, Guam, the Philippines, and Puerto Rico. Cuba, which was supposedly set free, but it became kind of like a gangster hangout. And had it been really set free and formed into a republic as America had, it would have been a lot better off, but it didn't, and so you got the Castro revolutions of the 1950s, and they're still suffering today from that horrendous effect. The Philippines actually escaped D.C. in 1946, and they're still a mess, and Guam and Puerto Rico remain territories. And something interesting about it, the headquarters of the Internal Revenue Service, or IRS, is in Puerto Rico. And I can give you the places where it shows that in the United States Code as well. Oh, a friend of mine says IRS means it's really Satan, but I digress. Nonetheless, D.C. specifically became a city-state by adopting a constitution. Now, it looks very much like the Constitution for the United States that was approved in 1788, but for one little word. The document adopted by D.C. is the Constitution of the United States. So, yeah, okay. So, dude, what's the difference? Well, let me tell you. This is from Wikipedia, or Wikipedia, as we sometimes say. Two of the most commonly used prepositions are of and for. These two, like all prepositions, indicate a relationship between objects in a particular sentence. Of is considered an old English preposition. It means away or away from. The preposition for, on the other hand, initially came from before, which also means on account of. So the city of D.C., the city-state of D.C., can be seen as away from or without the union known as the United States of America because it adopted the Constitution of the United States. Now, I've thrown a lot of stuff at you and a lot of words and word salad and stuff. All this machinations comes from the hands of a group called the Lexicographers, or Lexicos for short. And these guys are wordsmiths. They're also can be referred to as legislative draftsmen. Now, why would these guys be necessary? Because if they didn't lie, we'd be a lot better off. So the Supreme Court talks about lexicographers in a case called Merchants Loan and Trust Company v. Semtanka, decided in March of 1921 at line 28. Quote, in determining the definition of the word income thus arrived at, this court has consistently refused to enter into the refinements of lexicographers or economists and has approved in the definition quoted what it believed to be the commonly understood meaning of the term, which must have been in the minds of the people when they adopted the 16th Amendment of the Constitution. So, you know, it talks about lexicographers are kind of, you know, in lawyerly language, they would be known as smarmy buggers. So, but I guess the court also thought themselves clairvoyant because they knew what must have been in the minds of the people. Anyway, so lexicographers, or lexicos rather, a way of judging their art, if you will, is called the Flesch Index. That's spelled F-L-E-S-C-H, and that's the guy's last name that came about with this thing. And this index runs from 1 to 100, and it is a way of measuring the understanding of the English language. So as examples, the a typical newspaper is written at 8.5. A first-year college student understands about 11. And a law school graduate calms her hens at nearly 15. The tax code is written at an average of 33, with pieces as high as 55. These people have no intention of allowing you to know what's going on and exposing the scam. So one must invest a lot of time in understanding the language and how it's written, and therefore being able to understand the legislation, which is now statutes and codes. So now the justification for all this concerning the taxes goes like this. In order to be legitimate, a taxing statute must have three particulars. They are the subject of the tax, the measure of said tax, as well as a statement of liability. Now, the statement of liability obviously is the most important, because if you don't know you owe something and somebody jumps up in your face and wants to take your stuff, then probably violence is going to ensue. And so, you know, peaceful is better at this point, so we want to make sure that these lexicos give us a proper statement of liability, which they never do. But anyway, that's the way we have to do it. So the Constitution for the United States designates two great classes of taxation. And that great class is actually a line from a Supreme Court case. the two classes of taxes are direct, which is applied by apportionment, and indirect, which is required to be uniform throughout the several states. So those are the two designations within the Constitution, and here's where that comes from. In Article 1, Section 2, Clause 3, quote, representatives and direct taxes shall be apportioned among the several states, which may be included within this union, according to their respective numbers. So that's why we have to have a census every 10 years to know how many house, how many members the House of Representatives gets, or how many representatives each state gets, and also to do a direct tax. And there hasn't been any direct taxes by the United States in over 100 years. So Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1, quote, the Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excise, to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and the general welfare of the United States, semicolon, but all duties, imposts, and excises shall be uniform throughout the United States. Okay, so that's where the uniform place comes from. Article 1, Section 9, Clause 4, no capitation, which capitation means head tax, or other direct tax shall be laid unless in proportion to a census or enumeration herein before directed to be taken. So that's where back at Section 2, Clause 3 talks about. So so we have the last one here. This is Article 1, Section 9, Clause 5. No tax or duty shall be laid on articles exported from the states. And we also looked at the 1808 thing that said, or the first part of the Constitution earlier said that there could be a duty or excise placed on imported slaves. All right, so that brings us down to, you've got the direct tax, which is done by apportionment and valuation. And there are only three possible taxable categories, all right? They are people, property, and activities. There's nothing else within the known universe, and you can think on that a while, but I've done it. It's not there. So the direct tax is done by census enumeration, which and or valuation of the property. So that goes, you count all the noses, and everybody that owns a nose pays a piece. And then you, for property, you value the property. We'll say it's a lot and worth $100,000. And then they have a millage rate, and these are usually by county or parish. That's the Louisiana word for county. So county or parish, and they have a millage rate. So we'll say the millage rate, which a mill is 1,000th of something, so it'd be 1,000th of a dollar in this case. So the millage rate would be 7. And so 7,000th of 100,000 would be the tax bill for that property. All right? Excuse me. So then, so what that leaves us with, we've taken care of people and property, now we're left with activities. And so that is what the indirect tax is upon. It's upon activities. And in order to mentally differentiate between direct and indirect, I like to use the word excise instead of indirect taxes to keep it separate. Okay, so excises are placed on activity. However, there's got to be a way devised to measure the activity, because you can't just tax, you know, just throw a tax at something and not have a way to measure it. So what they've done is they've come up with two things. Is they either count the production of the activity, or they place a flat fee on the capability of the production, or a piece of the pie that is required for the production. So I often ask when talking about this, is there an excise tax on whiskey? Well, whiskey is a product. It is property, and it comes in a bottle or a flask or whatever. So it can't be an excise tax on whiskey. All right? It must be, and if it's not the subject of the tax, then it therefore must be the measure of the tax, because we've only got three things, right? Subject, measure, and statement of liability. So the whiskey, which is property, but it says that the tax is on whiskey. No, it's actually the subject of the tax is distillation, because that's what creates the whiskey. So, and it's been determined that distillation is a privileged activity. Now, there's several people in this world that will have a discussion on that with you. Nonetheless, so the subject of the tax in this example is the privileged activity of distillation, with the measure being the containers of the whiskey, or they just place a flat fee on the capacity of the distillery. All right? All of this is in the alcohol taxation portion of the Internal Revenue Code, in case you get really bored and want to go look it up. Either way, there's a stamp put on the containers to show that the tax has been paid. Now, we jump down to the 16th Amendment, and this states, the Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes on incomes, comma, from whatever source derived, comma, without apportionment among the several states and without regard to any census or enumeration. Okay, so as we've just said, that direct taxes are by apportionment, census, enumeration, and valuation. So if it doesn't have those, which is what it says right there, then it can't be a direct tax. So this power that Congress has is to lay an income tax on incomes. But the only thing left is an activity, and income is not an activity, so therefore income can't be the subject of the tax. It must, in fact, be the measure of the tax. So we know by going and reading the statutes at large in the 1900s and 1910s that in 1909, they 3 weeks after they passed the 16th Amendment and sent it out to the states to be ratified, they felt they had the power, and so they read Revenue Act. And it was a tax upon income with, and this is a paraphrase, it's a tax upon income with respect to doing business in the corporate capacity. All right? Excuse me. I forgot one particular word. It is an excise tax on income with respect to doing business in a corporate capacity. So that came about in Flint v. Stone Tracy, and then the second one that came up is called Stratton Independence. And we'll jump there first. So Stratton Independence at line 415, quote, and however the operation shall be described, the transaction is indubitably business within the fair meaning of the Act of 1909, and the gains derived from it are properly and strictly income. Okay, so the gain is the income. It is a thing. Therefore, it can't be the subject of an excise tax. Again, back to the line, and the gains derived from it are properly and strictly income from that business. For income may be defined as the gain derived from capital or from labor or from both combined. And here we have a combination of those operations of capital and labor. As to the alleged inequity of operations between mining corporations and others, it is, of course, true that the revenues derived from the working of a mine result in some extent to the exhaustion of the capital. But the same is true for the earnings of the human brain and hand when unaided by capital. Yet such earnings are commonly dealt with in legislation as income. So it may be said for many manufacturing corporations that are clearly subject to the Act of 1909, especially of those that have to do with the production of patented articles, although it may be foretold from the beginning that the manufacturer will be profitable only for a limited time, at the end of which capital value of the plant must be subjected to material depletion. The annual gain of such corporations are certainly to be taken as income for the purposes of measuring the amount of tax. There you go. Supreme Court tells us that income is the measure and the subject is doing business. So jump down to 417 in Stratton, and we see this, quote, and the return which was to be made under oath by the president or treasurer or other officers having like duties, indicating in the clearest manner that it was set forth data that with the proper accounting would appear upon the books of the corporation. In other words, the government can go and look at the books of the corporation and say, okay, yeah, this was the income, which is revenue minus deductions, and that is the measure of the tax of doing business by the corporation. And that was, again, from Stratton Independence v. Hobart in 1913. So to jump back a second, Congress is barred from taxing anything that sustains our right to life. Okay, so they can't tax your ability to breathe. They can't tax your labor to get the property that you need to support. Okay, those are out of bounds. So when they say there's a tax as our income, it has to be something that is applied for or chartered, which again is a corporation's. And this came about under the case called Flint v. Stone Tracy. Again, this was the first one after the 1909 Act, and it was settled in 1911. From Flint at 151, the tax under consideration, as we have construed the statute, may be described as an excise upon the particular privilege of doing business in the corporate capacity, with the advantages which arise from the corporate or quasi-corporate organizations, or when applied to insurance companies for doing business of such companies. Jump down to 152, it says, if business is not done in the manner described in the statute, no tax is payable. So, and down at 161, we find this, quote, in the case at bar, we have already discussed the limitations which the Constitution imposes on the right to levy excise taxes. As I said before, they can't levy an excise tax on something that you require to live. And it could not be said, even if the principle of the 14th Amendment were applicable to the present case, that there is no substantial difference between carrying on a business by the corporation taxed and the same business which is conducted by a private firm or individual. The thing taxed is not the mere dealing in the merchandise in which the actual transaction may be the same, whether conducted by individuals or corporations, but the tax is laid upon the privilege which exists in conducting business with the advantages which inhere to the corporate capacity of those taxed, and which is not enjoyed by private firms, private partnerships, or private individuals. You'll hear private firms later. So all of that being said, it comes down to this line in today's Internal Revenue Code, which is Title 26 of the United States Code, at Section 01, quote, excuse me, Section 701, quote, a partnership as such shall not be subject to the income tax imposed in this chapter, period. Second sentence, which reveals exactly what we just discussed, persons carrying on business as partners shall be liable for the income tax only in their separate and individual capacities. So the income has got to be the measure of it, because it says persons carrying on business shall be liable for the income tax. So there's the differentiation. All right. We jump back and forth a little bit here, but I guess it may make sense later on. Anyway, so there's this thing about when you write a law, okay, there's this thing called a rules of statutory construction. All right. So we'll go back to this, and says a partnership as such shall not be subject to the income tax imposed in this chapter, period. All right. And then it talks about persons in the second sentence. So do all of those words use the Webster's definition? No. All right. So one of the main rules of statutory construction is that if you're going to redefine a word or a phrase into a term, it must be, when reading that particular piece of legislation, you have to use that term definition. Webster's is out the door. So where do we find these? Well, the lexicos put these in various different places, and I referred to it earlier when we talked about the federal corporation with a definition section. So in the Internal Revenue Code, the main definition section is found way over in 7701. And there we find this. Section 7701 definitions A. When used in this title, were not otherwise distinctly expressed or manifestly incompatible with the intent thereof. Nice words, Sally, right? Number one, person. The term person shall be construed to mean and include an individual, a trust, estate, partnership, association, company, or corporation. Did you see man in there anywhere? Man with a capital N. No. So when it refers to an individual, well, what individual is that? An individual what? An individual doorknob? So, section two of the definition section, the term partnership includes an unincorporated organization. And that's just part of it. It goes on for multiple words after that. So now we see, as in 701, we see that the partnership is an unincorporated organization. Well, it just so happens when you go to get a limited liability company from some of the, one of the Secretary of States of the several states, you fill out a thing called the Articles of Organization, which is the application. And when the Secretary of State reviews that, they give you a certificate of organization. So we could go back, understanding that, we can go back to 701 and say the LLC as such shall not be subject to the income tax imposed in this chapter, period. All right? And that happens to be Chapter 1 of the Internal Revenue Code, which is also labeled the normal tax, because all of this was written up in 1913. Congress called it the normal tax, and they placed the tax on income. But because of Flint v. Stone Tracy, they got to leave off excise, and they got to leave off with respect to. Well, how do we know that? Before I get there, I got to read you this last one. So when we looked at number one and number two of Section 7701, and now we go down to number 20, employee. Quote, for the purposes of applying the provisions of Section 79 with respect to group term life insurance, purchase of employees, so on and so forth, for 109 words, it gets down to the meat of it, and it says, the term employee shall include a full-time life insurance salesman who is considered an employee for the purposes of Chapter 21. And who is the first thing listed in Chapter 21, which is the FICA? That would be the officer of a corporation. Oh, now, how did this get all back to it? Well, let's look at FICA is found in the Social Security Act of 1935. So that act was created in 11 separate titles. Now, this was done by, because FDR knew full well that this was unconstitutional from the word go, but they did it in 11 separate titles, so if one of them fell, the rest would stay in. So it was a legislative maneuver, as they talked about it. In Title II of the 1935 Social Security Act is where we find FICA and we find the Federal Old Age Benefit Reserve Account. Okay, Section 201 says, there is hereby created an account in the Treasury of the United States to be known as the Old Age Reserve Account, hereinafter to be called the account. I suggest going and getting the original and original legislation and reading this, the Social Security Act. It's tough, but it can be done, and you'll find out all kinds of really good things about it. So, one of the interesting things about it talks about these qualified individuals, and it says that there shall be no citizenship test given to them. So jumping back to Title I of the 1935 Social Security Act, there we find old age assistance for the state, and then in federal, then Title II is the federal old age benefits, okay? So now we see the differentiation. The government knows that there's two types of citizen. They know that there's the American national who is not subject to their their whims, and the DC slave or Social Security slave, or however you want to determine it. And they write it down, but they just do it in such a word salad that, you know, that typical Americans have no idea what they're talking about. So back to the Social Security Act, we run up to Title V, and here's where we find the taxes, which are FICA, okay? And, of course, everybody has been told since they were born, pretty much, that the money that is taken out in FICA goes into to pay for their Social Security. That's not true. It goes into the general fund, and then the Social Security benefits are created by apportionment by the federal government from the general fund. So Title VIII, which says taxes with respect to employment. Remember that with respect to back in the 1909 Act? Here you go. Section 801, in addition to other taxes, there shall be levied, collected, and paid. Let me stop there. Those three words, or those four words, are now used in today's Internal Revenue Code. They just say imposed. So, in addition to other taxes, there shall be levied, collected, paid upon the income of every individual a tax equal to the following percentage as of the wages received by him after December 31st, 1936, with respect to employment. Okay, well, we just said, you know, we just saw that the employee is a full-time life insurance salesman or the officer of a corporation. And some other word salad saying what it looks to be other people, but that's what it always breaks down to. So in the same time that they brought, in the same session that they brought out the Social Security Act, they also brought out the 1935 Revenue Act. And this is what it says here. There shall be levied, collected, and paid for each taxable year upon the net income of every individual a normal tax of 4% per annum of the amount of the net income in excess of credits against net income provided in Section 25. Everybody get that? I'm sure you're all cross-eyed by now, but here we go. So they brought forward a thing that's the income tax, otherwise known as normal tax, which is what Congress called it back in the 1913 reworking of the 1909 Revenue Act. And so they brought in this subject, this surtax. And so this is what is called in the Communist Manifesto a graduated income tax. And here's how they graduate it from Section 12. Surtax on income. As used in this section, the term surtax net income means the amount of net income in excess of the credits against net income provided in Section 25B. B. Rates of surtax. There shall be levied and collected and paid for each taxable year upon the surtax net income of every individual a surtax as follows. Upon the surtax net income of $4,000 and up to $6,000 is 4% per annum. And then they graduated up, and I'll just go to one of the last ones. It says, for the 286 upon surtax net incomes of $500,000. In other words, 70%. All right? 70% is what the tax rate was in 1935 for that amount of money. So I'm sure you guys caught those little things called includes. So we want to show you where that comes from. The definition of includes is found in the Social Security Act of in Title 11, and it says at 1101A6, the term employee includes an officer of a corporation. Oh, same thing that's in Chapter 21 of the Internal Revenue Code right now. But, oh, you say, well, hey, dude, you know, that means, you know, the officer of a corporation, the janitors, the machine workers, all those people. No. In 1101B, they redefine that, and they say the term includes and including, when used in a definition contained in this act, shall not be deemed to exclude other things otherwise within the meaning of this term defined. Didn't that sound fun? So if you review that, oh, by the way, they redo it in 7701C today and in today's Internal Revenue Code, which says the terms includes and including, when used in a definition contained in this title, shall not be deemed to exclude other things otherwise within the meaning of the term defined. So when we look at that and do a diagram, we come up with about three double negatives. So when you take all the double negatives out, we get this. The term includes and including, when used in a definition contained herein, shall be deemed to encompass only the things listed in the term defined, period. All right? So whatever's in the term list, where we talked about earlier, you know, the it says the term employee includes a full-time life insurance salesman. That's it, except for Chapter 21, which includes the officer of a corporation, which we talked about back in the earlier Supreme Court decisions. Those officers are the ones that have to file the return. Isn't it fun when it all comes together? I know you're shaking your head now, but that's okay. So when you have done the change to American National, you protect yourself and you get your family protected, and then you protect your stuff because you can still be sued. So how does all of that come down to what we do? I'm about to tell you. So our company goes and we make contract with a client, and we agree on the name of the that the client would like to have his limited liability, his or her limited liability to be. And we try to get as close to that as possible. So what we do is we go and apply for a limited liability company. Oh, by the way, LLCs were first legislated in 1977. And they are pieces of the corporation and the partnership, which have been around for hundreds of years. And they put them together, and then they changed certain words so that you would know by reading which business form that you are reading about. So once our company makes contract with a client via Michael Edwards' organization, then we take one of our people and it goes to the Secretary of State of New Mexico. And you'll find out why we use New Mexico shortly. So we go down and we fill out, one of our people fills out the articles of organization. Now, on the New Mexico Articles of Organization application, it requires a minimum of two parties. The title of those parties are called the organizer and the registered agent, all right? But the great thing about New Mexico is both of these can be other LLCs. So you can see how having LLCs that own LLCs that own LLCs makes for a great bulwark, and there's nobody's name on the public record which the articles of organization go into. So our company has multiple LLCs, but we have a pair of particular ones. One does acts as the organizer. The other one acts as the registered agent. The organizer is headquartered down in Alamogordo, New Mexico. The registered agent is up in Raton, New Mexico. So we put those LLC names on the application, known as the Articles of Organization, send it to the Secretary of State. He blesses off on it, sends it back, and says, you can now do business in this company name. And the piece of paper that he gets is called a Certificate of Organization. Here again, back, it's not a corporation. It's an unincorporated organization, which goes back to Section 7701. Excuse me. So once we have the certificate of organization, another of our people goes, and these parties have never filed a 1040 U.S. individual income tax return. Therefore, they are without the jurisdiction of the IRS. IRS cannot talk to them, and we have verified this multiple times. So they go down, and this is all done on the computer nowadays, thanks to COVID. They apply for a tax identification number for this new company, this new LLC that was just formed. And when they fill out that application to get the employer identification number, which is a form of tax identification number, otherwise known as EIN, they they put the application and fill it out properly, and then it gets the new company an EIN. One thing about other the states, you know, we said that that LLCs can own LLCs in New Mexico. So other states, like particularly Delaware and Nevada, when you go to incorporate or organize, you have to have people's names on there, and it makes a thing called a nominee list. So now Delaware and Nevada protect that list, but it still exists. In New Mexico, it doesn't exist, and you can't find something that doesn't exist, right? So once the new company gets its EIN, that party, one of our people that is on that application, is known as the sole member at that point. That sole member then takes and has a meeting of the company and commissions a third party as a manager. Now, manager is the only officer of an LLC. Corporations have things like president, secretary, board of directors, and so forth. Partnerships have limited partners and general partners. The corporation is owned by shareholders. The partnership is owned by percentages of membership. The LLC, its only officer is a manager. Now, you can put whatever you want in front of it, like chief executive or so forth and so on, but that's it. It's got to say manager. However, the company can have as many managers as it wants. The company is owned by members having percentages of membership, but that can be taken out to the fourth and fifth decimal, so you can have as literally as many members as you want, or the company can, I should say. So, oh, by the way, when the guy goes and gets the guy or gal goes and gets the EIN, they ask this question as part of the application. Why is the LLC requesting an EIN? Question mark. Okay, there's like five things, but we always select the middle one, which is called banking purposes. And this is what it says in the subheading. Select this option if the reason for applying for the EIN is strictly to satisfy banking requirements or local law. Did you hear anything about taxation in there? Nope. That's because they know the truth and they have to put it in there somewhere, and this is where they put it. So the guy getting the EIN or gal getting the EIN goes in and says, okay, now we commission this manager. The manager brings those three pieces of paper into the office. The three pieces of paper are certificate of organization, EIN, and their commission as a manager, which is also known as the letter of authority. They can then take those three pieces of paper down to a local bank and get the new company a checking account. Everything about the checking account is under the company names and numbers. Yes, the person that's doing that activity has to be identified as part of the know your customer things that banks are required to do, and crypto houses too. But anyway, but it's not the client. Everything that we do here at our company is to protect the client's identity and allow them to own, control everything with no ownership entanglements. So then we bring all that back and we bring up a pay-as-you-go cell phone and we load up the electronic banking. We like to include Square App and Cash App. The Square App is a point of sale and Cash App is a peer-to-peer transfer platform, both of which can provide checking accounts for the new company as well. That just came about in the recent past. So what that whole thing comes together, we put it in a box, we ship it to the client, and all that shipment is private. There is no registration at places like the Secretary of State of New Mexico or anything connected in the public eye that has the client's name or numbers on it. It's all our company's people, which are protected, as I've said. So that once that client opens up that box, pulls out all this stuff, they have become equipped to carry on business worldwide and income tax free. What are your questions?
All righty. Thank you so very much. Press star 2 on your keypad, ladies and gentlemen, to raise your hands. Press star 2. Our first caller will be Cameron from California, followed by Michael in Las Vegas, New Mexico, Nevada. And we'll see who comes from after that. Stand by. There we go. Go ahead, Cameron.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you for taking my call. I've got several questions. So the first one would be, is the LLC package dealing in the private or public?
The LLC is best in this venue, if you will. It's best known as a commercial interface. Okay. The public side of it has to do with the Secretary of State of New Mexico and all of that in the IRS and everything. Those are public records, all right? The transfer between our company and the client is private. It's never registered anywhere. And it says, so that's the private portion of it. The overall public-private differentiation or spheres, if you will, don't really cover what we do. So that's the best way I can tell you. You know, we do all the public stuff and then hand it off to the client, and it's a private transfer. And the clients are also commissioned as manager. And if the business deal was of sufficient quality, then they may reveal their ownership of the LLC. But it would have to be a really good deal to drop that anonymity that we build into it. Does that answer your question?
Yes. Okay. Very good. Second question. Can the LLC be penetrated by any state agencies to be audited? And then does the LLC need to be reported to the IRS once a year?
No. You want the long answer?
Yep. Semi-long. Yeah.
So I've got where I always do that. Yeah, there's a short answer and a long answer, and sometimes it can be really long. But anyway, as I said, the application to get an LLC out of New Mexico is called the Articles of Organization. It requires two parties, the organizer and the registered agent, both of which are LLCs of the creation of our company. So that public record is on there. Oh, another thing about New Mexico LLCs, they are exempt from reporting. The only requirement of an LLC in New Mexico once established is to have a registered agent within the confines of the state, but that can be another LLC. So there's nothing to penetrate. And it is as registered as it's going to get, which is only the Articles of Organization. As far as the second part of your question, remind me again what that was.
Does it need to be reported to the IRS once a year, or does it need to be some accounting every month? How does that work? Just like a regular business, or how does that work?
No, the only time it talks to the IRS is to get the EIN for banking purposes only, and so it's registered. And I believe it's section 6001 of the Internal Revenue Code that says that the Secretary of Treasury must notify somebody if they're liable for the tax. I'm paraphrasing. And so that is the opportunity for the Secretary of Treasury via their watchdogs, the IRS, to notify the LLC if it had any tax liability. But we know from section 701 of the Internal Revenue Code that that's not the case. So, and the fact that New Mexico LLCs are exempt from reporting, basically what that means is once these things are formed, and they're formed in perpetuity, and they stay in good standing, quote, in good standing, end quote, which is the verbiage for that they are viable, but they don't have to talk to anybody ever. Does that answer your question?
Okay. Yes, thank you. And then I've got two more questions here. The third question, isn't it possible to – you know, for me to personally apply for an EIN and then place it into an irrevocable trust where I can operate my business as a trustee?
Yes, and that's one. That is what is being offered here today. As I said, we're best known as a commercial interface because if you were trying to go to get a, just as an example, if you would to walk into a bank and try to get a checking account for a trust, they kind of look at you sideways because a lot of things about trust have been maligned, and the people have used them for bad things. Okay, but the business world, in the business world, everybody knows what an LLC is. So as part of your Americans Restoring America umbrella, we offer this as a commercial interface, and then two charitable religious trusts, which become 50% owners of that, but they're in the background. Everything as far as the business community sees is the LLC. And then, of course, you know, in a complex situation, there may be a need to have more LLCs. It doesn't matter. That's all details. The point is that this is a really fantastic way of doing business, and it protects you 13 ways this side of Sunday. What else?
Okay. All right. Very good. And my final question is, so I'm assuming that a CRT is some type of irrevocable trust under ecclesiastical law, correct?
True. Yes.
Okay. And is there a difference?
Sir. Wait a minute. I have to correct you. I'm sorry.
Okay.
The CRT, the Charitable Religious Trust, is a court-ordered trust under ecclesiastical law. Now, does it have any parallels in civil law? Yes, it does. In civil law, characters and the nature of the CRT would be seen as an irrevocable, non-statutory, spendthrift trust.
Okay.
Got it?
That is
the correct answer.
Okay, thank you. Is there a difference? Is there this difference from a well, I guess you answered my question, but I'll ask the question anyway, then you can just say yes or no. Is there a difference from a charitable religious trust versus common law or irrevocable trust?
Major differences. Absolutely.
Okay. And can you maybe give maybe just a little of the pros and cons?
Sure. A common law trust, if you go to any state statutes in any state of the union, go to a law library, they have tomes, volumes of books. They all look identical except for the fine print. They're taupe in color, about two-thirds up the spine. You'll see a red band across each one of them, and then if you look in the red band, you'll see gold lettering that describe what the statutes are that are within that bound volume. Go to the very first book, open it up to the very first pages, you'll see it say preface. When you read the preface, it will say something, and I'm paraphrasing here as best as able because they'll differ from one state to another. But basically it says, quote, paraquote, this state recognizes the following jurisdictions: Admiralty Court, Bankruptcy Court, Chancery Court, Common Law Court, asterisk, Ecclesiastical Court. Then you go down to the asterisk at the very bottom, and it says, except where otherwise noted, this state has incorporated the common law into this state's statutes. In other words, the common law doesn't exist in the paradigm of the American common law for those men and women who have corrected their status. For those men and women who have corrected their status, only the American common law is applicable to them, unless they are on the land of the United States, which is Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17. Then they can be charged accordingly.
Okay, yeah. So go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, so what I'm saying is that the common law, as we think about it today, is not the common law that's in reality. The common law in reality has been hijacked, has kept the same name, and it's been part of the statutes of the state. So good luck with that.
In other words, So in other words, a common law trust in today's vernacular would be a statutory trust.
Correct. Absolutely. Hmm. So when you go into a courtroom and you start pontificating about common law, the judge gets a nice little smile on his face and says, hey, I can handle that.
Right. Yeah. Okay. And so I just want to make sure I'm clear on that. So, but if somebody has done their status, to American State National, then they can technically still use a common law trust, irrevocable trust though, right? Or no?
If in fact that's true, yes. Now I want to throw several stipulations out there.
Okay.
If Cam is out there with whatever limits of knowledge that he has in the law, which has produced certain fruits over the past decade of his life or two decades of his life,
mm-hmm.
he will have that much success in litigation and defense of himself in a civil court. And question of your status as an American national, since I'm privy to the background to that, is up for question. You may remember that some of my first probing questions to you were, has this ever been tested out with law enforcement, with a LEO?
Correct.
And
yes,
your answer was negative.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So I don't know in the process that you have walked through if you truly do have or have corrected your status. Don't know that yet. Won't know until you get that blue light special in your rearview mirror, you hand over your pass card, and the officer goes back to his office, his magnetic strip swipe, comes back and it says, red flag, do not investigate, do not detain, release immediately, lifetime concealed carry weapons permit. We don't know that until that day happens, until you test it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yeah. And that's what your passport status package includes for your clients is exactly what you were saying there?
Our students have that. I'm part of that process. I actually do part of that work where I communicate with the student, I communicate with the State Department. I put everything together as I've been taught by GW, and if there's ever a question or an issue that's off my pay grade, I immediately conference in GW. You know, answer any questions that I can't answer at that time.
Okay, very good. I appreciate it. You've answered my questions. Thank you. I yield.
You're welcome. Okay, thank you so much, Cam. Good night. Next is Michael in Las Wages, Nevada.
Good evening. If you'd like to ride along when I get the status corrected, we'll drive to Arizona because they'll stop you if you're doing over 85 and we'll be doing 105.
Yeah. Hey. Well, hey, listen, we just had some very interesting,
brother.
I don't want to take time away from Mr. Slevin, but I have two updates to report with regards to two students that jumped on the bandwagon to correct their status because of situations. One is a student who went to Arizona on vacation and they want him to leave on probation. He had a taillight that had a problem, so they pulled him over. Wasn't speeding or anything else, just bad taillight. I guess they went shopping or hunting. And when they weren't satisfied with his answers, they put him in the car, handcuffed him, et cetera, and then said, we're going to inventory. We're going to have this car towed, so we're going to inventory its contents. And he objected to it vigorously, vehemently, and quite loudly. And they went ahead and went through his car. They found a stuff. They found firearms, etc. And I've got my students confused here. I beg your pardon. This fellow had CBD or whatever it's called, gummy bears, and they were allegedly outside of the amount that you're allowed to carry, and on that. So he had $5,000 cash on him, okay? And by the way, on a side note, if you're ever carrying cash, go to a box store like Staples or Kinko's or whatever and buy a $35 banker's bag. They have a lock on the top. It takes a court order, warrant, or judgment to get past that lock. It takes a very sharp, sharp, sharp knife to cut the reinforced canvas that it's made of. So if your money is in there, if your a weapon is in there, even if they can feel the print of the weapon, they can't open it up, and they cannot draw conclusions from it. So anyways, the bottom line is we learned today that he received in the mail a $5,000 check back from whatever Yapaho or whatever the name of that city is in New Mexico or wherever it was, Arizona. And we're waiting now for the paperwork to show that his charges have been dropped. Anyways, just wanted to share that.
The one question I had when you were talking about you were talking about the Constitution and the law, and it said holding an office for honor and profit.
Mm-hmm.
What's the definition of honor and what's the definition of profit that they refer to?
I'm not sure about that. What that is, typically honor is that you do things honorably when you're given an offer, you respond honorably and not venture into dishonor. And that's a long
clean hands doctrine.
Yeah, clean hands doctrine. Yeah, that's it. Obviously, if it's for profit, the officer of a corporation operates in an office for profit.
But representatives or elected officials take an oath, and they repeat that paradigm of honor and profit. And I don't understand how you can be honor and profit in a public office for the people.
that would take a considerable amount of time to research and explain.
Let me see if I can't get Nancy Pelosi on the phone and she can ask that question for you.
That's all. I just wanted to throw that in there anyway. I'll be on the road back to Florida tomorrow or Friday, so as soon as the weather clears. But that's all I had to insert tonight.
All right. So let me go check Freedom's Radio real quick, see if anybody has posted a question there. No questions there. I want to thank everyone for almost. Hello, Kent.
Good evening. I want to ask a question. Last night on the call, John was talking about the difference between being natural born and being native born. You were talking tonight about being a free man versus being a freedman. Is there any correlation that you know of that we can draw between the terms that were being spoken about last night and the terms you're speaking about tonight?
Well, the reference to freedman and freeman was from Justinian back in the 600s, or, yeah, 500, excuse me. So that really has no correlation because they were talking worldwide there. As far as the Roman Empire was concerned, that was their world. So when you're talking mm-hmm. about the particular thing about natural-born citizen, in the reference to it in the Constitution, and that's the document you have to look at and the time frame in which it was written. So that would be those comparisons. So the two sets don't really have anything in common because they're separated by 2,000 years.
Okay. I noticed that some people, and I know this is not your particular topic, this is more along the line of GW, but I note that people today are attempting to make a distinction as to when you're correcting your status, that it should be corrected back to native born rather than leaving it open and there being some kind of assumption that you're correcting it back to natural born.
Yeah, if I may, I'd like to address that real quickly.
Yes.
Okay. Where I'm going is Black's Law Dictionary, 4th, 5th, and 6th editions. They have the phrase United States. Whether you're talking United States land or United States people, Black's Law Dictionary specific definition, in fact, it has three definitions. And after you hear these definitions and their applications, I must ask, who could ever answer yes to being a United States citizen without having stipulated which definition they are referring to? Mm-hmm. Definition number one, it may be merely the name of a sovereign occupying the position analogous to that of other sovereigns in the family of nations. This is referring to we the people, quoting Scott v. Sanford, quote, who were at the time option of the Constitution recognized as citizens in the several states, became also citizens of this new political body, but none other. It was formed by them and for them and their posterity, but for no one else. And the personal rights and privileges guaranteed to citizens of this new sovereignty were intended to embrace those only who were then members of the several state communities, or who should afterwards, by birthright or otherwise, become members according to the provisions of the Constitution and the principles on which it was founded, end quote. So if I were filling out an affidavit, an attestation, I could say, I am Michael Edward, the name of a sovereign occupying the position analogous to that of other sovereigns in the family of nations. I could say that because I have traced my genealogy in the public record from my coming into this world back to the 1750s. Actually, my went further back than that, but point being is that my people, I had boots on the ground. I had a grandfather, 8 times removed, named Nathaniel, who fought the British for the War of Independence. He also mustered back again in 1812. To fight the British again. So there are many of us by birthright who can make that statement and claim. The second definition, it may designate the territory over which the sovereignty of the United States extends. These persons are United States citizens and are, quote, classified as property and franchises of the federal government as an individual entity. Referencing the 14th Amendment with a democratic form of government. The third definition is, it may be the collective names of the states which are united by and under the Constitution. Now these people are quoting an old IRS W-8 Ben form are identified as Union State citizens, or the term American national as found at 8 U.S.C. Section 15.2 with the guaranteed Republican form of government. So you've got three definitions for the one phrase, United States. And if you don't stipulate, the black-robed wonder is automatically going to plug you into definition number two, the person that are United States citizens being classified as property and franchises of the United States. So what I'm saying is it's absolutely paramount that any time you appear in the presence of a court and that start side of the road when that blue light special began, that your appearance is special and not general. Special appearance and not general appearance. And then the next step is Here's the affidavit. So I've already put it in front of you. I'm putting it in front of you again, and there you go. The next steps in the gentleman that had all the contraband as far as the Arizona, New Mexico, I forget which state it was, is concerned, that law enforcement officer, as well as the prosecutor, in the next week or 10 days, is going to be receiving their criminal complaint of Title 42, Section 1983. And that will be done before the February 6th hearing that this student, defendant in error, will be attending, so that the judge will see what's in front of her. Should she not, sua sponte, on her own accord, kill the case right there? I hope that happens.
So under Title 42, are you making that part of a civil complaint also for damages?
We're just starting with that at that time for the Title 42, 1983, which its ultimate end, under the worst of circumstances, could have resulted in a death sentence for anyone convicted of that violation, even in the civil matter, because it immediately translates to Title 42, to Title 18, Section 242.
Okay, but I was questioning when you were saying that you're bringing forth within the next 10 days to 2 weeks a criminal complaint under 1983.
Civil complaint.
Right, that's what I was questioning, because you said a criminal complaint. So you didn't say Section 2.3. Okay, thank you. Now, also, I'd just like you to clarify something, Mike. In the past, you have said, and correct me if I'm wrong, that one could actually say, under certain circumstances, even though they've corrected their status, depending on how a document is worded, or you're having to execute some type of document to get in, out of the country, et cetera, that one could say, based upon these definitions, that you are a U.S. citizen.
Yeah. Yeah, I would have, if I was asked by a court, a judge, mm-hmm. a United States citizen, I'd have to say, Your Honor, you'll have to stipulate which definition of the United States citizen. And then I'd read it to him right there. Which one are you mm-hmm. stipulating?
Okay. Now, one final point, based on my original question. And I understand what's being said about, you know, we shouldn't draw a correlation from the era of the 600s to the present day with these terms. Do we think it's important that one distinguish when they're correcting their status, whether they're actually native-born or natural-born, according to the definition?
No, it's not required. Nope.
According to what John was saying? No, okay. When John was starting to delineate that last night, I was wondering whether that should be part of that program.
Yeah, we're only operating on the three definitions. That's all we need to operate under.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. No one else has asked questions. I want to thank Mr. Slevin for a wonderful call tonight. Do you have any closing comments, sir?
No, sir, but y'all have a great and bodacious new year.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. Everyone, we'll see you Saturday prayerfully with Justice Beshear with regards to the ultimate in asset protection. Until then, be safe, be well. Good night.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.